Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Affirmative Action. I'm your host, Antoinette Grajeda. We know there's a lot of podcasts out there, so we're grateful you've decided to give this one a listen. Affirmative Action creates a space where marginalized communities can have their voices amplified. Each month, we'll explore cultural and social issues from a variety of perspectives with the goal of expression and education. One of the inspirations for this project was a conversation I had with a friend about this idea of space and how we didn't feel like there were many spaces for Black and Brown people in our community. Turns out, he's not the only one who feels this way.
My name is Jasper Logan. I am an African-American artist, social activist, writer.
My name is Gabriela Arroyo, and I am a Latina company member for the Latinx Theater Project. I'm 19. I live in Rogers. I feel like space is kind of limited in a way, because like for me, before college, it was always like mostly white spaces, you know? And then when I went to college and with the Latinx Theater Project, it was like the first time I actually met a group that did theater for Latinx and for minorities. And so I think for me, a space where I feel like it's like I can be myself and I can show all my identities is really only Latinx Theater Project.
Speaking specifically for the African American community, we lack space in the idea of a knowledge-based sense of like, so knowing that there are other African Americans living within Northwest Arkansas that are identifying and going through the same struggles that I am, whether that be, you know, the struggles that like a person of color might go through, like in the work environment or just by living in a primarily different cultural space. So in a knowledge base of knowing that there are other people, that knowing that there are other African Americans around us within this area that we, you know, we rarely get to see or to come across. We rarely get to like congregate or meet together unless there's like something significant. So one, in that knowledge space, and then in the physical, like just in a physical space, like there are a few Black churches here that are amazing staples within this community that have been here for a very long time and do, you know, provide to some extent a little bit of that space, but we just need more of it.
Overall, just for our mental clarity and feeling supported and just in a form of community, it's important to have those spaces.
It's one of those things that you don't know is important until like it's taken away from you. You know what I mean? Like white people don't really notice it because they're everywhere. You know what I mean? But like, I'm pretty sure there's a term, racial fatigue, like the idea of like not being able to see people that look like you on a regular day basis. Like the idea that like every time, you know, every space that I enter into, I have to conform to their sort of ground rules, their sort of means of interaction. You know what I mean? Whereas if I'm with my Black friends, like I don't have to conform to anything. Like I already am part of whatever is, you know, whatever is present there. You know what I mean? Like I don't have to explain any jokes. I don't have to explain, you know, the movies that we all grew up watching. I don't have to explain, you know, the current news events that affect us, you know, and provide some sort of perspective to where they have to, they get to see it and understand. It's like, no, they understand like how we feel because we all feel in the same thing. We all see, you know, the same thing. And so without those spaces, without those sort of feelings on a regular basis, it just gets hard. Like it just gets hard to like always have to be sort of on in every space you go. You don't, it kind of feels like you don't have any place where you can just come in and relax and be like, oh, I can be myself here.
Mentally and emotionally speaking, it's important to be able to express yourself and feel comfortable. In college, in some of the classes I was in that were theater related, most of the people in the room were white. And so whenever I would express myself like through performance, I would feel a little uncomfortable knowing that there isn't anybody in the audience that I feel connected with. And with Latinx Theater Project, it's like I can show my Latinidad and not feel like there isn't somebody that understands where I'm coming from.
I know from experience that, like, we just kind of have to create these spaces ourselves.
I feel like sometimes when we create space, I think people who don't understand where we're coming from, they're like, well, what about our space? And I'm like, well, you have all this space. And so just having this idea that if we want to take space, we have to kind of force it in a way.
I think in some ways we need to stop looking to outside cultures or majority culture to open the space for us, to make the space more comfortable for us, to, you know, accept us the way we are. And I say that, but I do think we should continue to do that. Like, that is a necessary thing. And like, it's good for cultures to learn, you know, from one another and to build, because that, I think that's the overall main goal. But on the other side of that, I think we focus on that so much that we neglect our own ability to create these spaces for ourselves and to bring value to the spaces that we could create for ourselves.
There is going to be people that are going to feel like you shouldn't have those spaces. But we just got to keep pushing. I think it's by having groups already starting that can support each other and like, oh, you want to create your own space too? Let's support each other so we can have our spaces.
I think both of those avenues are very important. One, creating our own spaces where that we can invite majority culture in and say, hey, look, this is why we need this space and this is why we are so valuable. But also to give the people, you know, within our community that sense of, oh, this is where I belong.
So in that spirit, we're making the space for those who've been looking for it, who want it, who need it. We're taking that action of creating a place where your voice can be heard. We affirm that your words, your truths, your stories, they matter. So thanks again for joining us, and let's get to it. Police brutality, particularly against Black men and women, has been an issue for some time, but the topic has received much attention in the summer of 2020. The death of George Floyd has sparked Black Lives Matter protests not only nationally but globally. The death of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin in 2012 prompted the creation of Black Lives Matter when the man who shot and killed him was acquitted in 2013. The following year, a trio of deaths highlighted how police brutality can lead to the death of Black men. A white officer shot and killed 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. 12-year-old Tamir Rice was holding a toy gun at a Cleveland, Ohio park when he was shot and killed by police. Video captured by a bystander shows 43-year-old Eric Garner repeatedly telling police, "I can't breathe," after an officer wrestled him to the ground in a chokehold in Staten Island, New York. As the years have passed, we've learned the names of more Black men and women who've died following interactions with the police. Freddie Gray, Alton Sterling, Philando Castile, Botham Jean, Stephon Clark, Atatiana Jefferson, Breonna Taylor, and now George Floyd. On Memorial Day, 46-year-old George Floyd died after a Minneapolis police officer kneeled on his neck for several minutes while he was handcuffed on the ground. Transcripts from police body cam footage show Floyd repeatedly told officers he couldn't breathe. A study published in 2019 by researchers from Rutgers University, Washington University in St. Louis, and the University of Michigan found police violence is a leading cause of death for young men in the United States. According to the report, over a lifetime, about one in every 1,000 Black men can expect to be killed by police. If this summer's protests are any indication, Black men and women and their allies want that statistic to change. George Floyd is not the first Black man to die at the hands of police, nor is he the first Black man whose encounter with law enforcement has been captured on camera, but the reaction has felt stronger, swifter. To figure out what's different and where we go from here, I reached out to a couple of activists from around the state. Emma Davis and Layla Holloway are two University of Central Arkansas students who organized a Black Lives Matter protest in Van Buren after George Floyd's death. They're also members of the Governor's Task Force to Advance the State of Law Enforcement in Arkansas, along with Kendrell Collins, an attorney from Little Rock. Ricky Booker is an associate trainer, facilitator, and consultant for the Ideals Institute at the University of Arkansas. Since the fall of 2019, the Institute has served as a hub for training and support for diversity and inclusion efforts across the state. As we started chatting over Zoom about the events following George Floyd's death, Layla shared her initial reaction to the news.
The way I felt was like, I felt sick. It was sickening to watch that video. I couldn't finish it, honestly. And especially so soon after Ahmaud and after Breonna, it was partially like, I can't believe this happened. And also like, I'm not surprised. But that one was one that in my head, I'm like, every other police shooting like justified, but people have found some way to twist it. This is one that you can't twist it. And of course people did. But first I was sick. And then as a 19-year-old Gen Z person, I was like, I need to record a video and put it on Facebook. And then I didn't. I just shared a bunch of posts, right? And then Emma and I led a protest because we were mad. So that was kind of our, that's what we did. But my reaction and like my feelings were just like, sick. You can't find a way to defend this. This is unjustifiable. And then when I saw people try to defend it and justify it, it felt even worse.
Yeah, Layla put it really, really well. I felt the same way. I was very sickened. And I feel like one of the reasons why it hit me so hard was that, like, A, it was just out in broad daylight. And, like, the officer who was kneeling on his, on George Floyd's neck, like, had no sign of, like, remorse, no sign of any sort of emotion was on his face. Mm-hmm. And this happened, like, so soon after Ahmaud Arbery. And it was just kind of, like, it was kind of, like, a hit in the face of, like, this is how, like, being a Black in America is, like, this is what it's like. And I was so upset, and I was just so angry, and it was just, like, I gotta do something. And so, like, leading that demonstration with Layla was like a way for me to just kind of have at least a little bit of, I'm not really sure if it's comfort, because it, like, something like that, I don't know if you can ever really find comfort in that, but it was just a way for me to just try to, like, figure out how to process these emotions, like, and try to heal from what happened.
You know, what Emma said, heal, that word made me think a lot about what I was feeling in that moment. Like, honestly, someone reached out to me and said, you really got to see this video. This was at a point where I was already, like, having a really tough week. And I'm like, I cannot watch it tonight. And so I was like, I'll watch it tomorrow. And so I watched it the next day. And it's just like, you feel the whole range of emotions, right? So I'm not fully shocked that it happened, but I'm watching the video, and you also feel this surprise that it's even possible that a person could do this. And then you're enraged and you're angry. A friend of mine, he said he was, like, depressed for 2 days after watching it. I honestly couldn't even sleep that night after watching it. So it's just a range of feelings. But then finally you get to the point where it's like, okay, like, I know I've been doing the work, but now it's time to, like, step it up and, like mobilize with other people. And then there was so much energy, and that began to happen. Even, like, meeting Emma and Layla, like, it was cathartic, I guess, to be able to be around people who were actually trying to do something. We knew we couldn't change what had been done, but I don't know, like, you know, a lot of us are like, oh, we feel the need to go fix a situation. And this is a situation, unfortunately, that can't just be fixed, because we can't fix people's, like, hearts. But I think that healing, like, has to happen, at least, like, started happening, I think, within the past month or so.
Wow, some amazing thoughts and feelings there. I appreciate you all sharing those. For me, I would say that I was very angry as well, very upset. And I think it was because of, you know, George Floyd was one of many Black people that have been killed over the last few years that we've seen. And I think it just, for me, I just was very frustrated and very angry to see how casually the officer knelt on his neck. But it was not a surprise to me. And the reason why it was not a surprise to me, because when you look at the history of America, you know, Black people and people of color have been having their neck kneeled on for centuries now, 400 plus years, when we were brought here in 1619 and enslaved. And so for me, it was another call to action. You know, we do the work of diversity, equity, inclusion in the Ideals Institute every day. So we have conversations about things that have happened across the nation and things that have happened here in the state of Arkansas and how we can move forward to some healing. But in order to do that, it's going to take all of us. It can't just be a few people, and it can't always be the kumbaya moment. I think that's what, from people that I've talked to and even myself, what we're just kind of tired of the kumbaya moment. We're ready for some serious change and for people who are going to step up and show that, you know, all people have intrinsic human value. And I think that for so long, Black people oftentimes don't feel like that we have that because of how we've been treated in this systemic racism that continues to be perpetuated and how, you know, no one really speaks up about it. And so I think that that's where I stand on that. And I'm working toward trying to get to a better place. And so I've started writing different pieces and writing different op-eds in different newspapers to kind of release some of that stress and frustration.
Something about this feels different. The Black Lives Matter movement started in 2013 after the death of Trayvon Martin. And so when you think about that, that's been 7 years. But right now, it just seems very, very present. And the things that have happened in the wake of his death have maybe just felt more immediate this summer. There were protests in Minneapolis, and then there were protests all over the country. And then I was surprised when I started seeing them internationally. You know, there's been organizations distancing themselves from police departments. Cities like Baltimore are cutting their budgets for police departments. And then it seems to have expanded beyond that to this larger conversation about race in America, where people are calling for the removal of Confederate statues or just taking them down themselves. The Washington football team changing their name, you know, after all this time. What is it that's different about this particular tragedy? Is there something different, or, you know, why is all this momentum seem to be happening now when, again, it's not the first Black man to have been killed by a police officer?
I think this was one of the first times that white America really, like, saw police brutality in its rawest form. And I remember I was talking to like a few other activists, and I was even talking to my dad about this. It's like, he was talking about like when Rodney King, when that happened in LA and it started like the LA riots and stuff, like that was one of the first times that America saw like a bunch of police officers like beating up this Black man. And it was just like, everyone was like, oh my gosh, like this is a moment for like white America to see what like the police is doing towards people of color. And when nothing happened, it's like it sparked such a huge outrage. And I think the thing with George Floyd is it's like, this is one of the times where it's not something that can just be like hidden away in the history books anymore. It's not something that can just be forgotten about, because we see this video of a man dying right in front of us, and it was just like, it just shocked people. Like it truly, it really shocked white America to see that. And I think like the call to action just kind of like, I mean, woke them up a little bit. And it was just kind of like, you know what, maybe something is wrong. Maybe there is something we need to like reassess with what's actually happening in the country.
Yeah, one of the things that I would say that, you know, when you look at this moment that we're in right now, I would lean on what Reverend William Barber says, and he says that we're now in the third Reconstruction. And so if you look at the first Reconstruction, which happened in the 1800s, 1865, 1877, which was 12 years Reconstruction, that was a period of time that Black people have been the most successful. And they were, we had 22 Black congressmen. Black people had their own businesses. And because of white outrage and jealousy, that was overturned during the Great Compromise of 1877. President Rutherford B. Hayes made an agreement with the Southern Democrats at the time and said, hey, if you get me elected to be president, then I'll remove the federal troops from the South. And so, of course, he kept that promise when he became president, he removed the federal troops. And so that started Jim Crow. And so we had Jim Crow for over 100 years, but the second Reconstruction was during the Civil Rights Movement, and it started with the death of Emmett Till. So I would say that when white people saw the death of Emmett Till, one of the things that several historians say that, you know, a lot of white people felt was, you know, yeah, black people are different, they're not like us, but I didn't sign up for this, when his mother had an open casket funeral. And so that was the second Reconstruction, from around 1953 to about 1968. And so then you move forward to the election of Barack Obama, which Reverend William Barber says is the start of the third Reconstruction. But one thing that I really hold on to from Reverend Barber is what he says is, in every single one of those Reconstructions, there was what he calls a fusion coalition. And that was people of all races coming together to challenge the system. And so with the election of Barack Obama, that's when you saw, you know, people from all races and ethnicities coming together and saying, we have hope and we want change. And so we're still right now knee deep into the third Reconstruction. And so when you see the death of Michael Brown, when you see the death of Trayvon Martin, when you see Ahmaud Arbery and Breonna Turner, you see all these people, Alton Sterling, and you see so many people lose their life at the hands of police officers, and sometimes at the hands of those who are racist. And you see that, I think where we are right now is knee deep in that third Reconstruction. And I think we're gonna see some serious change that we've never seen before, because my great uncle actually, who is in his 80s, pushing 90 now, he's told me that he's never seen anything like this. And I've heard that from so many other people.
Yeah, just to echo what Mr. Booker said, you asked, Antoinette, why George Floyd being the spark to all of this? And it's not an isolated event. It happens in the context of all these things. One, like the deaths of other Black men and women, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor, all happening seemingly back to back, and also at a time where we're in the midst of an economic decline. We're in the midst of a pandemic. And so all these things conflating, there's a lot of tension, there's a lot of frustration, and it was already visible to us, the inequities that existed in the Black community. It was becoming more apparent with the COVID-19, because we see, well, why are Black and brown people more likely to die from this disease? And we see the layers of inequities, the systemic issues that have brought that about. And it's something that a lot of us already knew, but I think the dominant culture, you know, you get to the point where there's that critical mass of awareness, and here we are, everybody realizes there's something going on. It's like blow after blow after blow to a community, and there's eventually going to be an eruption, and we've seen the eruptions happen many times. You know, Mr. Booker talked about Emmett Till, we talked about Trayvon Martin. These moments happen because there's systemic issues that haven't been addressed.
Mm-hmm. And that's a bit of kind of how I feel. I think that white America is ready to have that conversation, right? A lot of it has been, I think I feel like a lot of white America have felt defensive when we talk about systemic racism, right? Because we say it's put into the system, you have white privilege, you have this political and social power that we don't have. And they're like, okay, but I had a bad life, I struggled. I think that they're finally ready to have the conversation and listen. And I think that's one of the big things, because there were people at, you know, Emma and I's protest that I had a teacher, and she was like, hey, my daughter and her super like conservative friend are coming to your protest. And so I think it's just one of those things where it's like, it is political, but also I think some people are looking at this in a moral or like a human way. Like they're like, this is a person that was treated terribly, and there have been tons of people that have been treated terribly. But then I think once they finally get past that barrier of like, okay, we're not just looking at politics anymore, right? And they just look at humans are being treated this way, and it's happening disproportionately to different races, let's look a little deeper. And so I think they're finally ready to look at the systemic problems, to look at the social institutions, and understand that it's okay to be white. We're not attacking white people. We're not saying your lives don't matter. We're telling them, hey, you've got these privileges that we don't have. You have life problems that will never be solely because of your skin color, right? And so I think that seeing George Floyd and looking at it in a human way, not just like, well, I'm a Republican, so I'm going to look at it this way. They're feeling that, like, on a humane level, rather than looking at it like, how would I vote on this issue, right? They're like, how would I feel instead of how would I vote, I think. And there were, I mean, our protest had majority white people, I think, in Fort Smith, Arkansas. So that's a big deal because we're right by, you know, Van Buren, Cedarville, all of that. So it was a miracle that, you know, people didn't show up with guns. So, which there were threats for that. But I think that it's just, we're just ready to be able to explain it to them and for them to listen and not feel defensive. I think just seeing something so raw and so unjustifiable.
So if white America is finally ready to have that conversation, where do you start? What is the one thing that you need them to know? You know, because like you said, this has been going on for a very long time and mm-hmm. it can take a while for someone to catch up. So what is that really important piece that, you know, you don't think white America understands or that they need to understand?
Just because it doesn't happen to you doesn't mean that it doesn't happen to other people. And also, like, just take a sociology class or something, like, do some research. I think once you learn about social institutions and systemic issues, it's really easy. Like, you look at the history, the real history, not the statue history, and you can see, hey, look, people were held back. We're 400 years behind you. Where these people are however many years behind you. So you have to understand that if you don't have a history of oppression, of course be decades and decades and centuries ahead of people that do have a history of oppression. So I think understanding those social institutions will help them not take it to heart, because I think a lot of Black people we don't care anymore, honestly. It's like, I don't care if this hurts your feelings. This is how it works. So I think, you know, trying to censor our words or try to soften our statements so people don't get defensive, feeling like we're attacking them. If they were to understand the social institutions and the systemic issues, then we wouldn't have to try to soften our blows, because they would know that we're not talking about them specifically. Or maybe we are, but we're not always talking about them specifically.
And let's just be clear, it is not the role of Black America to teach white America. It's something that America has to understand. Layla said the word, and this is the big thing that everybody, all of America has to get, is that we have to see things not as segments, but as systems. It's not just like when we talk about the criminal justice system, it's not just policing. That's one segment of the larger criminal justice system. We can talk about the education system, we can talk about economic, but all these things are interrelated. And I know other people like to say, well, if we just fix this, we just tweak this one thing, then things will get better. It's like if I have a broken finger and a broken wrist and a misplaced shoulder, fixing the finger doesn't fix the whole arm system. Mm-hmm. And so, like, and I think people got to begin to ask the question, like, what is a system? Because most people don't even know what that means. I would say that, I guess it's a collection of, sometimes it's explicit laws, sometimes it's just policies, and it's also people. These are actual people making decisions, and that system sometimes gets reinforced by, like, culture. It gets reinforced by, like, the narratives that get pushed, and these are the things that kind of drive the system, and we have to see that these things work together. And if we're gonna attempt to kind of change society, we have to kind of make large scale changes instead of just these small things that we try to, nibble around the edges with.
And one thing I would add to that is, in Dr. King's 1967 book titled Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community, one of the things he said is that Negroes hold only one key to the double lock of peaceful change, and the other key is in the hands of the white community. And so what I would challenge the white community to do is, I know that there's going to be times where the key is going to be heavy, it's going to be awkward, it's going to be uncomfortable, but you know, we need you to hold on to that key, and we need you to be able to use it. We want you to stay curious. We want you to lean in hard. And you got to understand that, oftentimes, white people will say these are my values. This is what I believe. But if that's true, then your actions also need to line up with what your espoused values are. And also, I would just say, definitely listen to people of color with the intent to change and not with the intent to challenge. Because I think we all, oftentimes we'll all do that where we are waiting to respond instead of using active listening. So I think that, those are some things that are really, really important. But the last thing that I'll say is, I think that we must all understand that there is no quick fix for a 400-year-old project of systemic racism. It's just not a quick fix. It's going to take some discomfort, some hard work, and some struggle to move past this, or to move through it, I would say. We can't move past it. We got to move through it. And so I would say we got to dig in and we got to sit in the uncomfortableness.
I think it definitely starts with understanding that these are systems that are like the root problems of what we're experiencing in America. I remember like a while ago, I was talking to a group of girls, like they were mainly predominantly white, and they went to predominantly white institutions in Arkansas. And I remember I asked them, like, do you know like the core of your university? And they were like, what do you mean by the core? And I was like, do you know the history behind your university? Do you know the history behind your organizations, such as like your sororities or some of the other organizations on campus? Like, do you know your university to its core? And a lot of people were like, they were kind of confused and they started to understand. I said, because when you get to the core of that, and when you find segregation, when you find racism at the core, it's going to be unrecognizable. And it's like, in order to take action, to really want to take action, it starts with that self-education of understanding that these are systems of oppression. And I think that once we define what a system is, how a system oppresses a group of people, you can like find different ways to try to, I don't want to say it too harshly. Well, I kind of do, but whatever. Like you have to like dismantle these systems ultimately, because in order for us to move through our issues that we face, as Dr. Booker said, like they have to be gone, because it's what's holding us back as a country.
Any final thoughts about what comes next or how to make sure that the conversation doesn't stop?
Don't stop talking about it. Like, just keep posting, keep writing, It's almost like I said writing. Keep protesting, keep just doing whatever to keep it loud, right? This can't, and it doesn't look like it's going to be, but this can't just be one of those things where we're like, oh, we're mad. Look at this thing that the Supreme Court put through. And then you post it for 2 days on social media and then it's gone. And then, oh, well, like, you know, it's you got to hop on it. You got to keep sticking with it. And one thing kind of shows is that, as you know, like there's a task force for law enforcement now. Do you think the governor just put that together the day that George Floyd happened, the day that Ahmaud happened, the day Breonna happened? No. After George Floyd, we were all fed up. So we all went and protested, and magically there's a meeting and then there's a task force. So you got to keep your voices heard so the people at the top that are making that institutional change, so they hear you, so you can get up there and make that institutional change too. Because it probably would have just stayed the same, or, you know, there could have been people in police departments that said, or just people in power that said, okay, well, we're going to make our own changes. But how would that look if people that are within the system and benefiting from the system are the ones altering the system, are the ones fixing the system, right? You can't always fix issues that you don't see yourself. How are you going to fix an issue if you don't know it's an issue? So we have to keep those voices heard. We have to keep those issues at like the highest volume, because if they don't hear it, then they're not going to do anything with it. Because I guarantee you, the task force, it's not like he had it in his head the day that any person was killed unjustly by any kind of institution. So I think that's one of those things where it's like, keep your voices heard. It's not a coincidence that these things are happening after there's, you know, social uproar. So just don't stop talking about it. Keep it going. Don't stop talking.
Yeah, I agree with what Layla said. I mean, the protests in general is just one tool in the toolkit of trying to create change, mm-hmm. right? And so I hear a lot of people using the phrase now, how do we go from protest to policy? And I don't think it's an either or. I think sometimes you gotta do both to keep things relevant. But I think that is the next step we have to ask ourselves. Like, mm-hmm. how do we like implement real change with like, we have a voice, okay, somebody hears us, but now what are we saying? I think we have to like, as a people, as a collective, educate ourselves on what the most important issues are, what is the agenda that we can all kind of, you know, gather around and say, this is what we want to see change. Then the next step, of course, is, you know, putting people in office who are going to push those policies. A politician is just a vehicle to push policies. So I find and identify candidates who actually represent what I value. And, I think John Lewis said that the vote is like one of the most powerful things in our democracy. I would actually say it's probably the second most powerful. Like, we also got to like financially support like our dollar. We got to support and put money behind people who are running for office or run, you know, ourselves, whatever we need to do in order to make the policies happen. But I definitely think it's like going to have to be a collective effort. So we kind of got to get educated and get organized.
Absolutely. One thing I would add is, you know, research is very clear. There's a mountain of research that shows that, you know, white people are consciously unbiased. The majority of white people are consciously unbiased. However, they have very high levels of unconscious racial bias. And most white people don't identify that. They don't even know they have it. And so that's just one part of something that, you know, I would say definitely the white community needs to do is to identify what racial biases you have. And we have those because of historical context. It's been advertised. It's been in everything that we can think of, little subtle things that put stereotypes in our mind about Black men, about Black women, about women in general. I mean, if you look at, you know, how women are treated in the workforce. And so I would definitely say to identify, you know, your biases. That's one of the things that we do is we do unconscious bias training. But again, that's one small piece in this big piece, this big map or big puzzle of systemic racism that we have to overcome. And what I would also say is, you know, oftentimes when people think about, you know, racism, they think that racism is a spectacle. And this is what Dr. Reverend William Barber talks about in his book, The Third Reconstruction. They think that racism is a spectacle. You know, if someone calls you a racial slur, or what we saw happen to Ahmaud Arbery, or what we saw happen to George Floyd, that's what they think racism is. But to be quite frank, you know, we really don't know if you're a racist until we know what policies you vote on. You know, are you going to deny a child good education? Are you going to deny people health care? You know, we live in what people oftentimes say, we live in the greatest country in the world. But did you know that out of the 25 richest countries in the world, we are the only one that do not have universal health care, that does not have universal health care? So think about that. The policies are really, really important, but oftentimes people don't think about it in those ways. They think about it as, oh, if it's a spectacle. So what I would challenge, you know, definitely, you know, the white community do is just think about, what if this was you? What if everything that has happened to the Black community, everything that has happened to people of color has happened to your community? What if it was your son that was laying there on the pavement, you know, with a knee pressed on his neck? What would you do?
I agree with like all of those 100%. I think one of my biggest things is like calling out like the racist in your personal life. I remember someone once told me, they said some people like they can be actively like not racist, anti-racist in the streets, like maybe even a performative activist, but they're not willing to lose a relationship with a racist in their life. And at first I was kind of like, oh yeah, no, not me. I would never. And, you know, as somebody who's adopted, and my family is white, like sometimes it's hard for me to kind of grasp that because I do know like family members that are racist, like despite me being part of the family. And it was just kind of like, I think that's something that like definitely white America, and I feel like people in general should challenge, is like your family members, like people you consider your friends, like once you see them, once you hear them talk about other people of color, like what are you going to do? Are you going to allow them to talk this way? Are you going to just like gently nudge them and say, hey, you know, probably shouldn't say that when my black friend is over? Are you just going to like actively say like, hey, that's not acceptable here, like not in our family, you know? And another thing I would say that's like really important is like definitely knowing, like being educated on policies and who is going to be like representing your city, your state, like for your country, like and just getting educated on that, because one step, it's not completely like complete obviously, but one step to dismantling these systems is to remove the people who are enforcing oppressive systems on other people. So if you can get them out of office, if you can establish like what you want in a politician or what you want in somebody who's leading your city, your state, your like your federal government, like once you establish that, you can take some pretty big steps as to what you want in the future for your country.
Mm-hmm. And I just kind of want to bounce off of that really quickly. What Emma said about like calling out your white family members or your racist family members, like kind of hit home with me too. So like my mom is white and my dad is black, but my mom is remarried to a white man. And so my mom is very pro Black Lives Matter, very pro everything that we're doing, right? And so some people have been saying things about, well, you know, here in my area, we don't treat people like this. We treat people the same, and it's majority white. I think the high school that Emma and I went to was like 2% black, and that was back in like 2012, 2016. So most people just go to Fort Smith for school because the white community is just kind of overwhelming for black people. And so someone was saying, like, you know, we don't treat people like that. So my mom makes this whole thread on Facebook, explain, like, from the time she met my dad to now, of all of the times that she has watched us experience racism, all of the times that she has seen racism on behalf of us or my dad. And one of my dad's family members, she's really old, had said something along the lines of, hey, people do to you what you let them do to them. Don't teach your kids to be victims, right? Which is a terrible thing to say to someone who just told them how many times their kids have been called the N-word. And so, you know, it could have been the whole, well, she's old, you know, let it slide. No, like I was not very nice on social media. Not very nice at all. And it could have been a thing where like people are like, respect your elders, they're your family. And my mom didn't expect any of that from me. And so it's really important to see white people not covering, you know, non-racist white people covering for racist white people because they're old or because they're family. So that is a really, really big thing to me. And I got to see that firsthand, that it's super important. And so Emma had talked about, you know, whether you're non-racist, anti-racist, performative ally. My mom could have posted all of those things telling about everything that's happened to us and then let a racist family member slide, right? So it almost, what she did wouldn't have mattered, because what was the point of posting all of that if you're just going to let someone publicly comment that you turned your kids into victims by letting them be affected by racism? And so I think that's a really big thing, calling out your racist family members, but also not stopping other people from calling them out. Just don't protect them, because that's kind of a big problem that we see within the police force, right? Well, there's some good cops, but are you a good cop if you're protecting bad cops? Just because you've never done anything wrong, but you're still protecting those people, that makes you bad too. And so I think that's kind of a thing with the whole, you can't just be non-racist, like you got to be anti-racist. You can't just not be racist. You've got to actively dismantle, work to dismantle racism. That's what Emma said really struck me, because it was just kind of emotional to see how easily that could have turned into, well, let's dismiss them because they're family. So if you're not willing to lose a relationship with the racist, then you're not actually fighting to end racism.
My guests today were Emma Davis, Layla Holloway, Kendrell Collins, and Ricky Booker. Emma, Layla, and Kendrell are all members of the Governor's Task Force to Advance the State of Law Enforcement in Arkansas, and Ricky works at the Ideals Institute at the University of Arkansas. We also heard from Jasper Logan and Gabriela Arroyo at the top of the show. Thanks to all of them for speaking with us on this first episode of Affirmative Action. A special shout out goes to Nikita Reed, the founder of Arkansas Soul, who inspired the creation of this podcast and gave it a home. Arkansas Soul was created in 2019 under the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas and provides high school and college students with real-world media experience in generating content for diverse audiences. The online platform is expanding to include content from a variety of contributors, such as yours truly. Nikita, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity and for creating a space for much-needed conversation. I appreciate it more than you know. To listen to new episodes of our podcast each month, visit argotsoul.com/affirmativeaction or subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts. You can also find additional content from this episode, like photos of George Floyd tributes in Minneapolis, on our website. Thanks again for checking us out. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and we'll see you next time.